Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and with me today are Becca. Hello, Becca.
Hey, Chris.
And Charles Eisenstein. Hello, Charles.
Hi, Chris.
Now, all three of us, we're all going to be presenting at a new story festival that's coming up in Connecticut, and it's on June 12th and 13th, coming right up, and I'm really excited to be doing that because the timing in this, boy, is it ever good for me. You know, there's a vibe in the air, an electric energy among the people that I talk to be doing things differently. People really want a new story, and they're ready for a new story, and myself especially included in that. A common concern that Beck and I confront in our work, especially at live seminars, also on the website, is that people feel like they're living two lives, and that their so-called normal life is out of integrity with either their internal passions that lie in their hearts or what they know to be true about the state of the world in their heads, or both. So here to talk with us about where we are in the story, where we're headed, the joys and the pitfalls we might expect to find along the way, we do have Charles Eisenstein, lecturer and author of the books The Ascent of Humanity, Sacred Economics, and The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. So Charles, I'm really fixated on the idea that there's really only one way forward that offers humans a decent future, and that it involves the very thing you've been eloquently writing about for years. We have to change our stories. So how do we go about unpacking this idea for our listeners? I mean, you know, it's not stories like Hansel and Gretel per se, but I mean our main cultural stories. And I was really taken recently with your excellent and intimate telling of the story of the woman who planted corn. Because in there, I thought that you illustrated the many layered cultural stories that serve to steer us firmly towards some actions, maybe away from others. Can you tell us about that story?
Well, where should I begin? You know, maybe I'll get to that in a minute. Before we officially started, you were talking about so many people feeling, or maybe you just said it, so many people feeling that they're living kind of a double life. And that is not surprising, because on the one hand, we live among institutions and habits, such as the institutions of money and economics and government and school and so on, politics, that are built on an old story, or you could call it an old mythology, and they embody that old story. But on a personal level, a lot of us have moved past that. You could say that our consciousness has changed, our perceptions of the world have changed, who we feel ourselves to be, that's changed. So how do we reconcile this changed self with the forces that are trying to keep us who we were, and that don't offer us reinforcement or even subsistence when we want to live from this new story, this new consciousness? Like everybody, you know, even if you're, so a lot of people feel this pull, you know, in the area of their work, their career, where what they're doing for money isn't what makes their heart sing. You know, at best, for many, many people, at best, it's like, well, you know, my job is challenging, it's rewarding, and so forth, but do I really care deeply about it? If money were not involved, would I still do this? Is this my heart's passion? Am I living my life or the life I'm paid to live? So for many people, it's in the area of work, but it could also be in any part of life, any way that we're programmed and corralled by the value system that we've inherited. So that's kind of the big picture. And so the story you mentioned, and let me know if I'm like going on too long, but the story you mentioned, the woman who chose to plant corn, that was a Native American friend of mine, like super smart young woman. You know, she went to Stanford, I think. She got into Harvard, like some special program for maybe it's for indigenous people or minorities or something like that, but like some super prestigious program, graduate program. And she turned it down to go back to her tribe and improve her fluency in the language and plant corn and learn the old ways. And that, it's like a really fundamental subversion of the story that says, even like this kind of enlightened version of the story that says, well, you know, we're going to let the marginalized join the game too. They get to have a seat at the table too. They get to manage the world destroying machine also. You know, we're going to let them in too. And she's rejecting that whole thing and saying, no, the most important thing right now that I can do for the planet and maybe where the real power lies isn't in what you guys say it is. So I that's kind of what the article was about.
I love that because it really speaks to this idea of how do we go about changing things within the confines of the status quo if they're products of the status quo. It's sort of this conundrum that infects a lot of things, global climate change movement, people who are attempting to really agitate for some big changes. And the status quo is just so brilliantly good at maintaining itself. And it has so many fingers in our personal stories, the larger cultural stories. It says it's everything about ourselves. So I'm imagining this woman that the amount of how difficult it must have been from a social standpoint to turn down that Harvard offer, because from the outside, a lot of people are going to be saying, are you nuts? This is how you were invited to the club. You get to do good things when you get in the club, right? And you could make real change there. But what she's saying is, I think, an increasing thing people have come to, which is, no, you can't really. You know, you can't change the status quo by getting subsumed by the status quo. If you can, you're a very, very unusual person, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to write off that approach entirely. I mean, maybe there are people who can work within the system to change the system. But, you know, I imagined Lila, her name was Lila, you know, becoming a professor someday at Harvard and, you know, teaching anti-colonialist courses and so on, you know, and critiquing the status quo. But in the back of their minds, the students are going to be thinking, but you're benefiting from the status quo. You've accepted its rewards. Why should I believe you? You know, and in a way, the status quo, one of the ways it maintains itself is by giving voice within like kind of contained, inconsequential spaces to dissenting opinions. You know, you take all the smart people, you lock them in a room and you call it academia, and you dangle some trivial rewards in front of them. And they won't make too much trouble there because it's just academic. And I'm overstating the case. A lot of academics are you know, firebrand activists and really shaking things up. But you know, those bribes can be very attractive. And, you know, you get to have some status also. Even as you decry the status bestowing system, you also get to have the status. So it's not a simple choice, you know, and I wouldn't pass judgment on anyone who chooses. I mean, ultimately, the real revolution here is to trust ourselves, to end the war against the self. It's not to exchange one set of ethical principles for another set of ethical principles.
I agree with you so much there, Charles. Everything that we're saying here, I see reflected in the personal journey work that I do with people. And, you know, all of the cultural status quo narratives are reflected internally with the belief systems that operate very personally within each one of us. And what I see again and again is that when people are courageous enough to be reflective and notice those stories internally and see and identify which stories are serving them and which stories are not serving them, it's very, very challenging. It takes a lot of courage and energy to leave the familiar path.
Yeah.
To leave the path that has been cooking along in a somewhat comfortable way for our whole lives, and to journey off into uncharted territory. And frequently what I see is that when people are in a period of great transformation, there will be these seductive beliefs from the past that were the old operating system, that want to come in and essentially pull the individual back to that familiar, comfortable pattern through whatever, self-sabotage or, many, many different ways that that can express. But that it requires so much consciousness and courage and dedication to keep stepping off of that familiar, comfortable path, either personally in your own inner work or in your life work or as a culture, as a society. It's not easy.
I'm always very careful to avoid invoking the terms of the old story, even as I'm trying to tell a new story. So one of the key notions of the old story is the idea that life is hard. Progress comes only through great struggle, and virtue, goodness, morality, wealth, health, et cetera, come through overcoming oneself, winning some kind of battle. So sometimes, that gets translated into the transformation of consciousness or spirituality. That it's gonna be this really hard thing that requires great courage, sacrifice, and dedication. I'm not saying that there isn't a place or a moment where we act with great courage, sacrifice, and dedication. But maybe the journey isn't defined by those things. Maybe Chris at the beginning said, we're going to have to change our story. Well, another way to frame that is the story is changing. And it's happening, this process is happening to us. Because when I look at what has propelled me to change my story, or what's changed my consciousness, I have to admit that it wasn't some stupendous, courageous act of will, but rather it was the old story falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
It became, even when I tried to cling to it, even that didn't work. And eventually I was like, okay, I give up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's happening to our society too. Like, no matter how tightly we cling to the way things have been, and no matter how strenuously the elites try to maintain normality, it's inevitable that they will fail, unless you believe that infinite growth is possible on a finite planet. Then maybe they'll succeed. But what I see all around me in personal life and beyond is that big change happens through a process of crisis, breakdown, uncertainty, emptiness, followed by the emergence of something new. So I think that the same is happening on a collective level. And these crises that won't go away, that can't go away, are, kind of an early to middle stage of this breakdown.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It is. It's a very much a psychological process, and I've been reading and delving more into what psychology has to offer us around denial. And it's actually a very rich area, and I'm learning a lot in there and understanding that denial has multiple stages and phases. And, first there's lots of them, but grossly we could say there's three big stages. The first is just, outright just denial. Oh, no, that can't be happening. And then the second is minimization. Well, that might be happening, but it's not really that bad. Humans have done these sorts of things before and survived. And then the third stage would be getting to the actual projection stage where you have to blame somebody for this particular outcome, that you finally can't avoid. But none of that, all of that has to happen before you break out of denial into the next stage of the turbulence around it. And what galls me a little bit is that this is just a normal human process. I guarantee you I have parts of denial in myself, maybe around aging, mortality. I've got them in there. And it's just normal. And that we should, if we were an intact, healthy culture, I think we would A, recognize that it's normal, B, that it's there, and C, that we would have some sort of way of holding people more carefully, knowing that when their stories break down around them and they have to move to that new story, that it is a turbulent time, but it's not, we shouldn't say it's bad or it's good. It might be intense, but strip away the judgment around it and just say it's a thing and it happens. Yep. And can we do it better? Because it's going to happen anyway. And what I want to try and get to in this podcast and all my work is not to cast judgment on how people are doing, as you know, are people doing this better or worse? Should we all be activists or not? None of that. It's how do we most effectively help each other navigate the changing story? I think so that I have a little goal in here, so that we can do it maybe more gracefully than less gracefully, maybe with more joy and consciousness than the opposites of those. Does that make sense?
I guess so. You know, I think I'm very much in a state of I don't know right now, and really resisting this role of the expert. I don't know, you know, if you know, we should be, you know, trying to accelerate the demise of the old story, if we should let that take care of itself and build a new one instead, if we should, you know, as you said, try to make the transition more graceful. I think all of these frameworks, all of these lenses have some use. You know, there's truth in what you say. There's truth in ignore the old and build a new. You know, there's truth in stand our ground and say no to the worst of the destruction at any cost. Like, there's truth in all of these things. Mm-hmm. And I can't offer, I could probably actually offer a persuasive argument for any of them. Mm-hmm. Persuasive yet contradictory arguments for all of those things. But again, you know, for me in this in-between place, this space between stories, where we are in unfamiliar territory, we have no map, we need to seek another kind of guidance. And Becca was kind of referring to this too, you know, this, you could call it inner guidance or self-trust or listening. You know, I look at it as a compass rather than a map. Mm-hmm. When there is no map, you need a compass instead. And so what is true north for you? You know, for me, it's kind of a feeling of aliveness. And so if I'm trying to make a choice, you know, do I, you know, accept the job at the investment bank and try to make change from the inside and use all that money for good? Or do I, you know, flip them the bird and go live in a yurt, you know, on a permaculture farm? Like, if I'm trying to make a choice like that, you know, I could give myself any number of reasons for each one. People are very good at fabricating rationalizations that seem to, you know, that dress up their choices in this clothing of reason and ethics and so on, principle, you know. But the way I make the choice is, well, what really feels alive to me? Mm-hmm. You know, what, it may not be like the most, the aliveness could take the form of it could be, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, excitement and rah, 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 but it often is. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going to make me feel excited to wake up in the morning? What's going to make me feel alive? And so, you know, sometimes people will write to me and ask for help in making choices like this. Sometimes they'll say, hey, it feels like the most alive thing for you to take that job at the investment bank, you know, and really trust that feeling of excitement. Because when you practice that, practice trusting that, when that job becomes no longer exciting, then you'll trust that as well. Because we don't know, like, you know, you make the oddest, seemingly inconsequential decisions and they take you into some whole universe that you didn't even know existed.
Oh, that's so true. Charles, that really echoes the exact frame of reference that I use in working with people around decision-making as well, which is that going inside and feeling what it will feel like, each one of the decisions. If you're at a fork in the road, what will it feel like to be that? What will it feel like to be the other? And where is the joy? Where is the excitement? And when you go through the feeling channel as opposed through the thinking channel, it's amazing how clear that can be. And the issue is, I think, in the way that we're all raised, it was that we're not raised to actually trust those feelings. Feelings are meant to be sort of cautiously skirted around, perhaps, but to actually really trust our feeling body, our feeling self, is fairly unusual. So when I'm doing some coaching right now with my son and his friend. We just finished watching The Crash Course together, and we're at the, okay, so now what? Like, what, you're 17 years old, you're 18 years old. How does this impact the choices that you're making in your future? And the way that I'm counseling them is to really start with their passion. What gives you joy? What do you love? You don't have to map out your whole life right now. All you have to do is take the next step. What feels good to you? What is exciting? What brings your passion to the surface? And step towards that. And then you can, just as you said, you know, if that means going to be an investment banker, you'll know if you develop that trust internally when that is not the right choice anymore. And, you know, we don't live in the world of go, you know, work at, you know, your grandfather's company for 50 years and get your gold watch. Like, people are shifting and changing, you know, careers and directions all the time. So it's not like when we make one of these choices, that's it forever. It's, you know, it's either good or bad and you're in, and it's the whole thing. You know, we're lucky to be able to be in this period of change and flexibility. But I really agree with that method of following that sense of aliveness. Where is the aliveness?
Well, and if we're, you know, let me take a slightly different approach on that. So here's my problem, Charles. I track the data. So, you know, when I read about the seventh whale washing up on the beach of California, or the complete collapse of the fisheries in the Pacific Ocean. Maybe it's the fact that there's a countable number of harvests left in the soil, the way we're currently farming it worldwide, or any of these larger ecological issues, or maybe it's just the economic issues. You know, the entitlement programs can be paid back if and only if, right? They can't. But the $50 trillion shortfall is still predicated on 3.5% growth forever. Right. Which, if you track that out, by the year 2080, the United States has an economy the same size as the entire world's is today. Right. So that means the United States in 2080 will be consuming as much as the whole world does today. And obviously that's too much for the world already. So I look at that and I go, wow, there is a big, big gap in the stories we tell ourselves. Right. You know, that, think of that one story. Our economy is going to grow at 3.5% for the next 100 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. I think anybody with a crayon can work out that's probably not going to happen. But everything in our story is predicated on that. All the decisions we're making about how we're prioritizing spending and what you can depend on or maybe not with Medicare entitlements, what your retirement is going to look like. There's a whole lot of nested narratives hinging on something that is just demonstrably false, at least to me. To me, that explains a lot of the cognitive dissonance or that dis-ease that people are expressing.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, even if on an explicit intellectual level, people, you know, haven't thought through the kind of things that you're talking about, people are getting it. You know, there's kind of a hollowness underneath people's participation in the routines and lifestyles and you know, what life ways of the old story. You know, they might still be putting their money in the 50, whatever they're called. I don't even know the names of these things. The retirement funds, you know, the life insurance policies, the pensions, you know, Social Security, but it doesn't have the same feeling of this kind of absolute security that it had a generation ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where social security was just part of the fabric of reality. You know, of course you're going to have social security when you retire. I don't think people believe in it anymore. Their participation is half-hearted more and more.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I look at it kind of like a, like the whole system is like this, like an egg or a big ball that is hollowing out from the inside. The surface structures seem just as strong as ever, if not even stronger. You know, the surveillance state, you know, the military industrial complex, like all those systems of control and dominance are, you know, more imposing than they've ever been. But no one really believes in them anymore. Even the elites don't believe in it anymore. They don't believe their own propaganda, their own ideology. And this kind of cynicism and impatience with it. You know, in a private moment, you get some of these guys and you're like, you know, don't you just want to walk away from the whole thing sometimes, you know, quit the charade. There was that, I can't remember where I saw this, but this guy interviewed something like 90 members of Congress and Democrat, Republican, Tea Party, it didn't matter, like off the record, they were like, yeah, I don't believe in any of this. You know, I'm just kind of going through the motions.
Mm.
What if everybody thinks that? It's like the emperor's new clothes, you know? Everybody's pretending that things are fine. I read I can't remember his name either, a Spanish intellectual who was saying that the power of the mass media does not come from everybody believing the mass media. In fact, nobody believes the mass media. Their power comes from the fact that everybody thinks that everybody believes the mass media. So I think it's very much like, and this hopefully isn't too tired a metaphor, but very much like the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, in the 50s or the 60s, the Soviet elite believed wholeheartedly in their system. We will crush, we will bury you. That's what Khrushchev said. We will bury you. And it seemed obvious, you know, Sputnik, you know, like the most rapid industrialization in the history of the planet, you know? I mean, this was like a thriving socialist society. Of course we're going to bury you. By the 80s, though, even though the apparatus of the Soviet state was just as strong as ever, the core had hollowed out. The elites didn't really believe, they weren't really Marxists anymore. Not really. That was just their vehicle to power. And I think the same is happening even on a deeper level now. These deep stories about what does a normal life look like? What is the purpose of life? Who am I? You know, what's real? How does change happen in the world? These are like the warp and woof of our mythology, you know, of our story of the world, of our story of the people that creates reality, that creates our systems, which are all story. I mean, they're all agreements. Money is just an agreement. You know, government is just an agreement. The state of California is an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
None of these have any reality except for our agreements about them. And you know, one by one, these crises that you're talking about, Chris, you know, we can insulate ourselves from them for a while, but these crises are not a story, you know, like the collapse of the fisheries, you know, whatever Karl Rove says, we're not going to change that fact by pretending otherwise. You know, these crises are going to invade our lives and pierce our stories no matter what. And when they do that, those stories are going to unravel, and they're already getting really fragile because of this hollowing out. So like every one of these, you know, anytime one of these crises slams into us, it just kind of fractures the structure of our story even more. And I think it's, I mean, I don't know, you know, how long it's going to last. And I don't even know if the collapse is going to be a single defining event. I think probably it won't. I think we're going to have a series of crises, each one of which deepens the unraveling. And because this is what happens in my life, you know, like I'll be delivered from my old story, my old habits of thought, my old habits of being. And I'll be like, yeah, you know, I'm free of that now, only to realize that I'm actually still programmed by deeper elements.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a spiral. Everything healing is a spiral, and the change is a spiral. It's not a linear process, and we have to keep circling around at a deeper level to these old cords that bind us, because they can be very subtle and quiet once you get through those, you know, noisy outer layers.
Well, and you know what strikes me about all this is that in this unwinding, it is going to be turbulent territory, because it's each thread as it unravels in that warp and woof, as you say, it all sorts of other things come under attack. So think about what I learned in elementary school about the American way, right? We're the good people. We're number one. You know, we have freedom and justice, fairness for all. I put my hand over my heart, recited these things, right? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you read about how you know, what should be a crowning moment in achievement in America, you know, the naming of the first female black attorney general, right? I mean, wow,
yeah.
You know, that should be great. And one of her first acts is to completely exonerate banks that were caught committing massive felonies by giving them a little slap on the wrist fine, and didn't even deign to tell us how much they might have earned from their illegal activities in comparison to the size of the fine they were getting tagged with, right? And what caught me with that was usually the comments. I was reading this in the Wall Street Journal. Usually that comment section is like an ignorant swap meet of partisan politics. You know, it mm-hmm. It's not a place to learn much. But the outrage in there was astonishing. It was 95% people going, this is an outrage. This is no longer good. And I couldn't detect, you know, it took quite a while for the partisan people to gain control and try and blame it on Democrats versus Republicans. You know, for the initial outburst was, this is just an affront to, I think, that core story that we have. Justice is part of the American way. There's a lot tied into that. Ferguson taught us we don't have justice, you know, to people who weren't aware of it. Poor people always knew that. Minorities always knew that. But middle class America started to figure that out. Baltimore continued that conversation. And then, you know, the next free pass for the bankers has just sort of cemented the view that, hey, maybe that's not part of our core story anymore. And if it's not, what new story is going to take its place? Are we now warlords? Are we now a Brazil style, you know, 1% versus everybody else thing? What are we? So it's up for grabs.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if even the Attorney General herself, in her own mind, you know, what was she thinking? You know, probably something like, well, you know, this isn't right, but, you know, this is just the way things are. And sure, in a better world, you know, they would get a much stiffer punishment. They would be, get the corporate death penalty or whatever. But, you know, that's not the way things work. And you know, because I find that when I talk to people who are in positions of power, they feel helpless to do anything but what they're doing. Their perception of their own freedom is very narrow. They feel highly constrained. We project power onto them, but they don't actually have the power. They are functionaries of the system. And you know, Chris, you were talking about the third stage of denial, which is blame. So people, you know, take that insight that they are puppets, and they imagine that there are, you know, these invisible puppet masters that, you know, the shadow government, the power elite, you can take it as far as you want, you know, the reptilian ETs controlling everything. And again, not that like such narratives don't give us a lens onto reality, but I think ultimately that kind of blame is a diversion from systems change. Like anytime you blame something that isn't the real culprit, you're actually being duped. and you're change efforts are then diverted onto something that isn't going to actually create change. And we saw that, you know, in Egypt when the people rose up and they deposed the dictator. Right. Problem solved, right? Because he was the bad guy, right? No, they got a new dictator eventually. Like everybody, you know, Morsi and then the next guy, like everybody who's in that position does the things that come along with that position. Some of them are a little bit better, some a little bit worse. But, you know, so what I'm saying is that the people we project power onto are not the people who actually have power, because they are not, or at least they have no more power than anybody else. Because real power, when it comes to changing the world, rather than, you know, being a functionary to maintain the status quo, real power comes through our ability to change the story.
Yes.
And they're under such tremendous pressure to merely maintain the story that that perhaps, you know, the woman who chose to plant corn, you know, she's not, you know, in the old story, well, she's kind of shirking the opportunity to exercise real power. But that view validates the metaphysics that locates power in the halls of our, you know, current power structures. Mm-hmm. Like, what if that's not really where the power is? Mm-hmm. You know, what if the power is, I don't know, like, you know, with the land spirits, you know? I mean, what if the world doesn't, like, on a really fundamental level, doesn't work according to the inherited Newtonian Cartesian force-based causality that we almost take for granted? I think the revolution that we're in has to go to that level ultimately. You know, it's not just about manipulating force in a more clever way.
You know, I've been really taken lately with what the quantum physicists have been up to, and they've done some really ingenious experiments. So a lot of people are familiar with this idea that, you know, light can behave as a particle or a wave, and it depends on the observer. And they've measured this 1,000 times. They're like, yeah, and that kind of weirds them out. And just a week ago, results got announced where they had done the same thing with atoms, not light particles or waves or whatever, but whole atoms just demonstrated the exact same behavior, which fit quantum physics is now telling us. And if this doesn't cook your noodle, you don't understand quantum physics yet. It's telling us that matter itself does not actually exist in any particular locus of reality until it gets observed. And that, at a very fundamental level, makes me question a lot of things, right?
Right.
And so what I like to do is leave my mind open to this idea that we as humans are both very immature in terms of, you know, our species isn't even 1 million years old yet. You know, what will we know when we're 10 million years along? And second of all, that there's a lot that we don't know yet. And I think a lot of the conceit of the Cartesian Newtonian thing is that we're on our path to knowing everything, but that's just down one path of knowing. And there are these other paths of knowing that seem to have a lot of very strong anecdotal evidence and now increasingly measured quantum evidence that says, no, there's something more going on here than just this narrow little world that you've been raised to believe is true. And I find that exciting because I actually find it depressing to think that the whole world, all of the universe could be calculated if you could just know the trajectories of every particle in motion, right? You know, I like the mystery out there, and I'm convinced there's a lot of mystery yet that we don't know. I mean, I want to know what my dog smells, right? I would love to know what a bee sees. They have senses outside of my ranges, so I don't even know, like, on the physical level, what's possible. But
right.
On other levels, it seems to me increasingly we're getting a lot of evidence that says maybe we should just hold open the idea that we don't know everything yet. A little humility would be called for here.
Yes. Part of our existing story is that reality is this thing out there, you know, that the world, the universe outside of ourselves is composed of things that don't have the qualities of a self, don't have intelligence, consciousness, and so on. It's just a bunch of stuff out there. So this, you know, and like you said, you know, if you know the initial conditions, then you can calculate the final conditions at any time in the future. So, you know, it's the Newtonian world machine. as Fritjof Capra called it. And this isn't just a philosophy, you know, it also has economic consequences, technological consequences. I mean, you know, based on that worldview, we're treating the world as if it really were just a bunch of stuff. Mm. Like, why wouldn't you? You know, like, I'm not going to, if I'm a decent person, I'm not going to ruthlessly exploit you, Chris, just to maximize my advantage. Like, I'm not going to, you know, screw you over, you know, beat you senseless, take your wallet, right? Because punishment aside, like, you know, I have some empathy. Like, I know that you'll suffer. You know, I'm not going to do that. But if I saw you as just an automaton, for example, if I had some racist lens and viewed you as subhuman, that would kind of legitimate my exploitation of you. And you know, we've made progress, I think, as a civilization. Obviously, there's still a long way to go, but blatantly racist attitudes are no longer acceptable in mainstream society. At least we can say that. There's no longer any debate about whether black people have souls or not. So we've made progress there, but we still see nature as precisely that, as something that, you know, natural resources that we are under no moral compunction to treat well. Maybe there's a practical reason, you know, if we don't treat it well, then you know, it'll be our own demise as well. But we still, even most of the environmental movement, aside from, you know, deep ecology, still their arguments, at least, are still based on universe as thing. You know, why should we care about climate change? Why should we care about plastic in the oceans? The answer is, well, because if we don't, something bad will happen to us. Mm-hmm. But if I said, well, why should I care about my son? And you say, well, if you don't, something bad will happen to you. Like that, you know, there's a problem with that.
Yeah.
You know, and if that's your argument, then my taking care of my son depends on deterrence, and that's never going to be enough. So I think that part of the change in our story, the transition in our story that we need to go through, is to reinvest the non-human world with consciousness, intelligence, sacredness, beingness. Which also makes us no longer alone in the universe.
I'm so glad you're bringing that up, Charles. I think that is the crux of the matter. I do believe that is the source of all of the expressions of destruction that we've got here, is that fundamental disconnection that we have that says, number one, that we're separate, and number two, that the rest of the world just is a thing, and it is not consciousness. And, you know, I know from my own personal explorations that, you know, my relationship with the natural world, as I'll say family, is some of the most deep, fulfilling, connective, you know, very embodied experiences that I can have. And that what I find as I connect with the natural world as family, as relations, what I find is that there is so much help out there. Like, when we open up that awareness of connection, I look and I say, well, where can I give and where can I receive? Where can I open up that giving and receiving loop with the natural world, as opposed to just consuming and using? And again, what I find is there's so much help. There are levels of existence here going on that are far, far, far beyond anything that we can imagine. And it is, in many ways, I feel like the experience that we're having is like 1% of the truth of what's possible. And it's super exciting to me because there's so much to learn. And it's also very sad to me that we are confining ourselves so, you know, stupendously to this tiny perspective of what is going on.
Amen.
Well, and with that, you know, we could keep this conversation going, and we will. And there's just so much to talk about. And so, Charles, I do want to bring up that for people listening on this new story festival coming up, it's for the Graduate Institute. It's an accredited institution. It's dedicated to the education of the whole person, body, mind, spirit. And the event starts with Charles, Becca, and myself at a VIP dinner to help raise funds for this great institution. That's Friday, June 12th. That's in Bethany, Connecticut. And then the new story festival open to the general public. That's on Saturday, June 13th in Hamden, Connecticut. Details at my website. You could also find it on Facebook and also at the Graduate Institute's website. So we have links to all that. I'll put a link at the bottom of this podcast. And so this is just a taste of the things that we are going to be talking about, which is this new story. How do it's happening, and how are we participating in it? How are we going to be with it? So, Charles, thanks so much for your time today, and I'm really looking forward to whatever we're going to do next.
Yeah, looking forward to it as well.
It's going to be fun.
All right.
I hope everybody comes.
All right.
Thanks, Charles.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you.